Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Hey guys, welcome back. This is episode 2 of Sublimely Gothic, the podcast dedicated to all your favorites of the romantic and paranormal since the 18th century. I'm Amy Sophia Mayer.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are going to be picking apart the precursor to all gothic novels, the one that started it all, or at least made use of the word gothic in its name, The Castle of Otranto, a gothic story, written by Horace Walpole in 1764. And before we get started, I wanted to introduce our very special guest speaker for this episode, Julia O'Connell.
Hi.
So Julia is a graduate from the College of William and Mary, very good school. I know a lot of colleagues from there. And currently, she resides in New York City, making her foray into the publishing industry. Most importantly for our podcast, she is the author of the fantastic blog, The Gothic Library, at thegothiclibrary.com, which I will put a link to in the description, where you can find all fascinating articles on nearly every element of gothic literature. So yeah, Julia, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Alrighty then, so let's get started. As I stated, we are doing Castle of Otranto, the one that started it all. So who wants to do their 60-second recap first?
I think I went first last time, so I'm not going to go first this time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So here, let me just count myself in. 3, 2, 1. Go. Okay, so it sets off in Italy, of course, very mysterious, and there is this guy, Manfred, who is going to marry his son, comrade to Isabella, but he gets smashed by a giant helmet that hails from the sky, which is never fully explained. And so he's like, oh my god, how am I going to continue with my family line? And then he's like, Manfred's like I'm gonna marry Isabella myself. But Isabella's like, no, I don't want to do that. She escapes paranormal supernatural phenomenon everywhere. Father Jerome helps her stay hidden from Manfred, and then Theodore helps her escape, and then Theodore meets Matilda, and Matilda likes Theodore, and then Frederick comes, who ends up being the real, and then it turns out that Theodore is the true heir to the castle, and it's fulfilling the prophecy, and I'm out of time.
That was a valiant effort.
Okay, yeah, I didn't even get to the part where Matilda dies.
The tragic.
I'll give it a go.
Okay.
Go.
Alrighty then, I'll time you in at 3, 2, 1, go.
So our young heroine Isabella comes to the castle of Otranto to marry the Prince Conrad, but on the morning of their wedding, a giant helmet falls out of the sky and crushes him. Manfred is obsessed with continuing his family line, so he decides he's going to marry Isabella, but then he gets spooked by a moving portrait of his ancestor. Isabella escapes through the secret passageways in the castle and is helped by a peasant named Theodore, but it turns out Theodore is not a peasant. He is the son of the priest, Father Jerome, who has noble blood. Isabella's father, Frederick, comes home from the Crusades just in time, and he falls in love with Manfred's daughter, Matilda. So Frederick and Manfred team up to marry each other's daughters. And then the ghost of Prince Alfonso, who was the last true prince of the castle, shows up like a giant in armor, and he screws with everyone until he gets Manfred to admit to being a usurper. And Isabella and Theodore live happily ever after because Theodore was a true heir.
Oh, dang,
that was perfect.
Yeah,
left out a few things, but
y'all better get ready for line? My recap. It's gonna be something else, let me tell you. Yeah,
are you ready, Jess?
I guess, man, it's y'all have set quite the stage, so here I go.
Okay, 3, 2, 1, go.
All right, so this takes place in Italy. They say it about 500 times at the beginning. It takes place in Italy. There are some very wealthy people. They're in a castle. A helmet falls down, and a man is crushed by this helmet. And the gore. So then everybody is all worked up and trying to figure out what the heck happened, why Conrad was, I probably said that wrong, crushed by the helmet. So then, Manfred is obsessed with getting his daughter married off. Then there's Hippolyta. Then there are portraits with moving eyes. And then I'm lost. So then everybody's freaking out. And then the spoiler alert: the father kills the daughter. Tragedy, death, sadness. Alfonso's a ghost. I loved every page of it. There you go. It's a little shorter than 60 seconds, but
okay. Alrighty then. So I think one thing we can mention maybe before we get into the story is Horace Walpole himself, which I don't know that much about him. Haven't read too much about him. All I know is from a few Gothic literature documentaries is that he was born pretty well off and therefore he had the time and the means to pursue his writing aspirations. And part of what he did in his obsession with Gothic stuff and Romanticism is that he completely redid his home in Neo-Gothic architecture, which was known as Strawberry Hill.
Strawberry Hill. He was kind of a weird guy, which I think was cool.
He was a weird guy. And again, and when you see his house, and again, how, you know, everything is a Neo-Gothic fashion, it drives home the fact of the notion of Gothic. It was a exercise in historical revisionism. And so, like, the Gothic, as we think about it, is not the true, really, you know, Middle Ages or early modern period. It's more like a dark, macabre, Disney-esque version of the past. And that was kind of driven home to me, like, by seeing that documentary, of seeing his house and the way he, you know, redid it.
That's cool. You know, it's funny that you mentioned, like, Disney, because the portraits with moving eyes, I don't know if y'all have been to Disney World.
Not insult me with that question. Of course I have.
Okay. the Haunted Mansion ride, that's what it's called, right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. That's all I could think about. I was like, oh, it's like that first room when you have the... Anyway, so, yeah.
That scene always makes me think of Harry Potter, because the portrait actually gets up and moves out of its frame and walks around. And I feel like J.K. Rowling must have either read this or read anything derivative of it that picked up, because it does sort of become a trope of portraits that can at least move their eyes or move a little bit. But this is the only thing else I've read that has them entirely get up out of their frames and walk around.
Well, in J.K. Rowling, it's even further, like, the fat lady has a purpose. She's a gatekeeper.
Yeah.
But that is an important element of all Gothic literature. You know, in Castle of Otranto and House of Seven Gables, it's always the portrait, but it also couldn't be like a statue in, what is it, The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. So, so that piece of art that connects the present to the past.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think I wanted to first ask both of you, when did you guys first read this book?
I read it probably about a year ago. I had already been several years into writing my blog. And, you know, you can't talk about the Gothic without talking about Otranto as the one that started it all. And I had read the Wikipedia summary a million times. That doesn't quite cut it. The Wikipedia summary leaves a lot out. So I was like, I should probably read this foundational work of Gothic literature if I'm going to present myself on the internet as an expert of sorts.
When I was working on my MLS, I read it. It was one of those things, and it just pops up everywhere later on. You just kind of see elements of it. So I was required to read it. But you know, it's short. It's weird. It's, you know, foundational. There's just so much to it. I was trying to, in preparation for this, look for a paper I know I wrote about it, but I couldn't find it. So, I'm pretty far removed from writing that paper. So I was really hoping to find it. But so I would say I read it about, 6 years ago. And then I tried to read it again, just, you know, to refamiliarize with myself with it. And it's pretty quick read. And I just always think it kind of like hits the ground running and doesn't stop. Like I felt, and maybe it was just because we were coming off of Jane Eyre. Jane Eyre is just like, that's a long journey. This was just kind of like, and then this happened and this happened. And then it's like, all right, and now we're done. So anyway, how about you, Amy? When did you first read it?
I read it like 9 months ago when I first started my book club, which like I explained last episode, it, you know, it concentrates on Gothic literature. And so Castle of Otranto is actually the book I chose of our group to read, because I'm just like, if I'm going to read this both in my club and my on my own, I need to know it. And right. Yeah, so I'm fairly fresh in like reading the book and then just the familiarity of like the storyline, because it's not one of those things like Jane Eyre where you automatically know like maybe everything about it from film adaptations or just pop culture.
Right, right.
So I think one thing I was curious of for both of you is, you know, in reading some of the, you know, analysis of Castle of Otranto, you know, they really, a lot of them acknowledge just how trashy the book was considered. Yeah. And so I'm asking from your guys' perspectives, could you genuinely get into the story, or was it just too melodramatic and fanciful to you?
I loved it. I feel like the melodrama is part of the fun. Like, one of the things you have to realize is that the Gothic doesn't take itself seriously. And so it's supposed to be over the top. And this is over the top in such a weird, unpredictable way, being the first one. You know, a giant helmet falls out of the sky, and you're like, what? Where did that come from? And you kind of have to read the whole book before you really understand where it came from. And I after reading it, you know, I had to read more about it and read it a second time to really fill in all the gaps. But yeah, there's a lot to enjoy about it, I think.
I agree. I mean, like, it's just kind of, like, it didn't feel the heaviness. I mean, I think Gothic and heaviness are kind of, I think people kind of associate those things, but it was just, it's just kind of like, this is just, like, I think I mentioned on the last podcast, I was excited to talk about this one, because it's just so weird. It's like, can you imagine being in that time, you know, I can't remember the date, but can you, 18, of course it's like 18 something, but anyway, I'm sorry, I don't have that quickly referenceable.
The publishing date, 1764.
Yeah. Okay, 17. Can you imagine being there and picking up that book and be like, what the hell did I just read? Like, I don't know, I just think that's just, I like stuff like that. That's just kind of so out there that at first you're just kind of like, and then you kind of have a time to sit with it. And I read A String of Pearls, Sweeney Todd. And I remember reading that and being kind of like, I mean, what the heck was that? And this one, I was just kind of like, this is fun. It's so weird and fun, but still there's enough of an investment, I thought. But anyway, what do you think, Amy?
I am in agreement with both of you, and I ask that not because it was my experience, it's just from reading some of the literature that analyzes, you know, the Gothic, some people sort of took that approach, and quite honestly, no, I was able to really invest in the characters, and I remember my experience reading it was feeling that the characters really represented the human condition. And then on that vein of being melodramatic, I've definitely felt that sensation more with something like The Monk rather than Castle of Otranto.
I have not read The Monk, and maybe you should kick me off the podcast now, but for some reason I've always been like, I don't know if I'm ready for this. So,
no, well, hopefully Monk will be season two. So.
Okay.
Yeah, so I guess we can start, you know, the story. I think we talked a lot about Comrade is just pummeled by the giant helmet. And so this puts Manfred in a situation that he needs to continue his family line. And for whatever reason, I don't think it's really explained, that Hippolyta is clearly, you know, infertile. And so he's like, I'm going to seduce Isabella. And then Isabella runs away, and people take this as being the classic damsel in distress. But one thing I was interested in talking about is the notion of damsel in distress and the subversions of it in Gothic literature, and how does that reflect, you know, female agency because gothic is all about, you know, the not the pure, innocent, you know, heroines, but and we don't really think of a damsel in distress stereotypically as having agency, but in a way, Isabella for the time period is being very revolutionary in trying to fight and trying to hide from Manfred rather than just miserably accepting her fate. So what do you guys think about that?
Right. And I think it's particularly interesting that, you know, she is a little bit of your stereotypical virtuous virgin, but that's what motivates her to escape him, because she really cares about Hippolyta and doesn't want to hurt her by having Manfred set her aside. And she's also deeply religious, and she believes that Manfred's desire to marry her is is against the laws of both nature and God, because she thinks it would be, you know, contradictory to her religious beliefs to marry someone who's already married to someone else, and also because she was engaged to his son, that they're already family, so that would be incest of a sort. She does show a surprising amount of agency of her own, even though Theodore comes along and helps her. He actually doesn't do anything except kind of divert and distract Manfred. They run into each other, and she says, "Help me find the trap door." And he's like, "Oh, okay." And then she finds the trap door herself. And so, yeah, she actually does a lot on her own.
Yeah. You know, now that you think of it, now that you say that, because I didn't think about her in that way. But yeah, she does. She's not just, she does take some initiative and try to save herself a little bit. Interesting. I don't have a lot to add other than that. But yeah.
Well, I wanted to actually, I was very smart before quarantine, and in preparation for this podcast, I checked out at least 10 to 15 books all about the analysis of Gothic literature. Nice. And so now and all the libraries are now closed, so now I have them all during quarantine.
Good, good.
So one of them I found was An Intensifying Vision of Evil, the Gothic Novel, specifically Gothic literature from 1764 to 1820. And so one of the things they talk about is characters and character archetypes, and they do mention Isabella in here.
Wow.
The blueprint for the Gothic heroine is, as in all the salient characteristics of the genre, presented in the Castle of Otranto. There are two central women figures in this story, Isabella and Matilda. The first one encountered is Isabella, Manfred's future daughter-in-law, the hope of his dynastic ambitions and the object of his sexual passion. His pursuit of her, her terror and flight, presents the basic relationship of persecution that exists between the heroine and the villain hero. Her escape is facilitated by Theodore, who later also rescues her from the forest when she has sought concealment. However, it is soon understood that Isabella, for all her virtue, is surpassed in noble qualities by the Princess Matilda. Isabella, beautiful and courtly, lacks the aura of sanctity that aligns Matilda with heaven. I don't know. What do we think about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know if I fully agree with it. I guess they're leaning that way because Matilda had talked about wanting to join a convent and dedicate her life to religion. But I think they're both very openly pious women, and we get more from Isabella's perspective, so it's hard to compare the two, but Isabella is very motivated by religion and by her religious beliefs. So I think I'd consider them both equally pious and noble.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because there are two women fulfilling different roles. Like, they're both virtuous, Matilda fulfilling a very religious, wanting to join a convent role, and then Isabella still being virtuous, but, you know, wanting to use her virtue to be a lady, to be a good wife, and, like, those sort of things. So they're just two different arenas of life.
Yeah.
And they both have a similar attitude towards the supernatural that's informed by their religious belief. I guess we see more of it in Matilda, but when her maidservant Bianca is like, "Oh, there's a ghost downstairs, there's a ghost," she's like, "Oh, I'm not afraid of any ghosts because I'm a good person and I haven't harmed anyone, so no ghosts would hurt me." She has this kind of view of providence that anything supernatural isn't going to harm her because she, like, trusts that God is going to be good to her because she's been a good and virtuous person.
That is a running theme, isn't it? Like we talked about in Jane Eyre, it's like that goodness. Goodness is rewarded. I'm trying not to talk about Dracula because you know I love that book. So, yeah, very interesting. Also, reflecting on Jane Eyre, thank God there were some ghosts in this for me because I was very upset by the lack of ghosts in Jane Eyre, or you know, the kind of maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But yeah, and Julia, you know, I'm just curious, when do you think like the first woman or female character that deviates from this kind of, I am at a loss for words right now, but this kind of, these characteristics shows up in Gothic literature. Do you think it's Lucy or do you think there's somebody before?
Oh, no. Dracula is so late in the game of the Gothic that like Dracula does not do much that's first. Okay. I think it's a bit of a gradual change because later in the late 1700s, you get Anne Radcliffe, the queen of the Gothic, who started this female Gothic subset of the genre. And a lot of her heroines might seem sort of the stereotypical heroine, but they do have a bit more agency. And
they're more fleshed out. Yeah. I've only read Romance of the Forest, but I checked out the Italian and a Sicilian romance and Mysteries of Udolpho, and they're waiting for me to be read.
Right. And you also have just about a decade after the Castle of Otranto, you have Clara Reeve's The English Baron, which I haven't read, but it is another one written by a woman, so I do feel that that tends to lend a little bit more depth to the female characters. She was intentionally playing off the Castle of Otranto, so I think you get a bit of a twist on the characters in Otranto in Clara Reeve's The Old English Baron.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So one thing I was really fascinated by, because I've only seen it a couple of times, and I'm sure it's been done a lot, but the idea that the book was not just a novel written in English, that it was translated from an earlier manuscript in Italian, trying to give credence and this whole illusion of, you know, history and foreboding and especially foreignness.
Right.
And so the idea, you know, me thinking about what are the, you know, implications of the racial profiling of having a lot of these settings, like the Castle of Otranto, be in Italy or like in Dracula, where it's in Central Europe.
Right.
Right. There's a lot of religious othering going on there. You know, I'm not super well versed in the religious history of England and Europe, but I guess Horace Walpole would have been Church of England. And, of course, Italy is associated with Catholicism, which you'll see a lot in Gothic literature, is kind of the foreignness and otherness and potential evilness of Catholicism.
The Antichrist.
not even that yet, but just that it's Catholicism is associated with superstition and, and yes, a subversion of the religion as the author would see it. And even in framing this text, he suggests that it might have been written by an artful priest in a monastery in Italy. So he's even like sowing doubt in the story by saying it was written by an artful Catholic priest. But that also just adds to the air of mystery around it.
Yeah, I find it interesting. One thing I found interesting is the role of Father Jerome. He's obviously a very benign character that helps Isabella and protects her from Manfred. And so the church in this regard is portrayed in a very positive light, which it definitely does not always stick in Gothic literature. A lot of it is super anti-Catholic via that othering.
Yes.
So I was just thinking, you know, it's more a political criticism than a religious criticism, because all the critical, you know, questioning goes to the notion of Manfred and the legitimacy of his political power, not so much whether the religion of the time has any legitimacy or whether it could be corrupted. It's all about Manfred being the mighty lord and he's a usurper and he's bad and, you know, his prophecy says he's doomed and all that jazz.
Right.
Yeah. If you don't mind with the, you know, the like I kind of jokingly mentioned in the very, very short analysis, reading this, it's like, by the way, this took place in Italy. Everybody calm down. It took place in Italy, you know, and I was just kind of like, okay, we get it. You know, it's an Italian story. So I remember in some of the other works I read, The Beetle is one of them. And then the name of the book escapes me, but it's about like an Egyptian goddess who they've kind of like brought back to life. The Othering, you know, is that, do you think with this book, the intention of setting it like not just down the road in England was to be like, This might be a little scary, but it's okay. It took place somewhere else. And then sorry to go back to the Egyptian stories, like with the beetle and things like that. That was another case of othering. So I just was just curious, kind of the through line for that. Like, this started with that. Is that a theme that we see in Gothic literature a lot?
Yeah.
I can't think of one off the top of my head. So,
I mean, yeah. I think there's a significant tendency to set Gothic stories first off a long, long time ago, and then often in a place far away,
right?
Because it helps with the suspension of disbelief, you know?
Sure.
You would have trouble imagining a giant ghost showing up down the road in England, because
right.
That doesn't seem something that would fit into your real life, but imagining a world that's already so foreign to you, where the people are so foreign and there are other beliefs around you and other religions, maybe there could be the possibility of the supernatural. I think it helps to just take the characters out of their element and then take the readers out of their element as well and make them a little bit more open to the mysterious and unusual.
Cool.
And then, of course, you do get the exoticizing other cultures. And right around the time when the Gothic became popular, the Tale of the Arabian Nights had just been translated into English, so everybody was obsessed with the Arabian Peninsula. So you get a lot of Gothic tales set in Arabia, and then, of course, in a lot of these European countries, like Italy.
Cool.
Yeah, I think... Oh, what was my thought? What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. I was going to say that... definitely, I think, you know, Julia's right in terms of, you know, having it in a foreign setting kind of suspends our disbelief and sort of creates, you know, dramatic mood. But I think there is also, you know, kind of, it's not just about the supernatural. I think it's also about it's critical in talking about like corruption of religion or corruption of, you know, political systems. But they're doing it in a way that it's like, oh, the Italians, they're the ones who do that. They're the ones that are so corrupt and are
right.
So bad. Trying to talk about critical issues, but still trying to disassociate it from themselves.
Right. And sometimes that was used as a clever way to subvert it. Like, they could be critiquing their own society, but by encasing it in this story that's in a foreign world, you know, it's a little bit more subtle.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that old narrative trick. How lovely.
What does it say about Theodore and his virtue and the notion of, like, virtue is dictated by one's heritage or bloodline? Because as we all know, Theodore is, we think, just this peasant and he helps Isabella out. But upon further reflection, we realize that he's Jerome's son, right?
Right.
Yeah, and Jerome was originally... Count Falconara or whatever, he was a noble, and then it turns out that matrilineally Theodore is actually the direct descendant of Alfonso, the true
Alfonso
prince.
So basically, do we just interpret it as Theodore is a good person and therefore he is rewarded with this poetic justice by this revelation of his parentage, or is it feeding into that notion that, you know, only good, virtuous people, you know, have that, you know, will have that noble lineages and the rest are just, you know, riffraff?
I think we do kind of see that in the Castle of Otranto, because pretty much everyone here who does have genuine noble lineage is a good person. I mean, I guess you could debate that about Frederick, but Isabella, Theodore, and Jerome are all good, and we see that the people that actually are peasants, their servants, are all kind of ridiculous. They're there for comedic relief. They're all really superstitious and dumb. So there is kind of the sense that, like, yeah, your nobility does relate to your character in the story. And you see that in a lot of other Gothic works, too.
And Radcliffe is very guilty of that.
Yeah, and even Victor Hugo, in the book version of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, the gypsy turns out to not really be a gypsy. She was actually a white person all along, so white that's how she can be good, you know? Hmm. And that's a trope, too, is like, oh, a person who you thought was a person of color turns out to actually have been white all along, and that's why they're good, is a trope that the Gothic tend to be guilty of.
I'm glad Disney left that part out and captured just normal Romani Esmeralda.
Yes.
I am so glad you mentioned that, because that is what I spent my my final project talking about, was Victor Hugo's The Hunchback of Notre Dame. So warms my heart a little bit to hear that.
I have yet to read it, but I do have it. I have a whole collected works of Victor Hugo. I need to read it.
That'll take a while to get through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's been a while, but I enjoyed it, I guess. I don't know. It's kind of hard to sometimes to enjoy something when you're, like, also trying to tear it apart. That's what I find out with my book clubs. We're like, oh, we really like this book, but here we are we're going to rip this thing apart for the next hour. Anyway. Y'all made a point, and I forgot what
nobility and character.
Oh, nobility and goodness, kind of. You know, something that, again, I thought was interesting is they kind of give the disclaimer at the beginning that, like, servants are ridiculous, so just, you know, ignore them, kind of. And I just thought that was, like, that's kind of rude. But, I mean, given what we discussed, it makes sense, but it was just interesting to me that, you know, there was a real emphasis on just making sure the reader knew that these people are ridiculous and we know it, but we still have to tell you about it. So, I don't know.
Well, I think we breached it a little bit, but I want to go into it further. Yeah, the notion of the moving painting, because that is ultimately what trips up Manfred when he tries to pursue Isabella. And she's able to escape in part because Manfred is so distracted by this moving picture of, what is it? It's Alfonso, right?
Yeah. No, it's Manfred's grandfather, Ricardo, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Who is, like, I guess, having belated guilt about his role in becoming a usurper.
Yeah, so, yeah, the moving portrait, like, I don't know, Julia, you're far more well-versed in this stuff than myself. Do you know any other literary comparisons that predate Castle of Otranto that sort of moving portrait?
I can't think of any that predate it. I can think of ones that come after. You know, obviously I mentioned that you see it in Harry Potter. There's an Edgar Allan Poe story, his first published story, whose title I can never remember, has like a portrait or a tapestry that kind of moves. Metzengerstein is a more obscure story by Poe's, and it has a portrait that kind of moves slightly. But yeah, I think this might be a pure invention of Walpole's, although I'd be interested to see if there's something he would have gotten it from.
I like the portrait and the statue things, because it melds two tropes of Gothic literature together. It melds together the supernatural element of the story with the, you know, paranormal phenomenon, and then it also weaves in the notion of past, because very often it's a portrait or a statue of an ancestor of the family who has probably done some nasty shit, and now the rest of the family is paying for it.
Right, and we have a few portraits in the story, because there's a whole gallery of portraits, and they mention a lot the portrait of Alfonso, which Theodore looks exactly like the portrait of Alfonso, and that's our first hint that he's the descendant. And then, of course, Manfred has this relationship with the portrait of his grandfather. So we kind of have both aspects of a portrait of an ancestor that is resembling a current person, either by looks or by actions and a connection of a past wrong that they are all being punished for.
Yeah. Okay. I am glad you said that, because for a second I was like, the portrait looked like somebody, right? So, yeah, it was the Alfonso, but it wasn't a portrait of Alfonso. Gotcha.
Yeah, there's a whole gallery of portraits, so those are the two that have important roles.
Gotcha.
One thing I wanted to ask, I can't quite remember. So Matilda falls in love with Theodore and helps him escape, right? Right.
Yes.
Yeah, so is it portrayed as... Is Matilda's love for Theodore completely unrequited? Like, does Theodore like her in return, and is, or is it just that Matilda dies and he settles for Isabella?
Yeah, they both mutually like each other, because when Theodore runs into Isabella in the forest and she's like, oh no, don't hurt me, and we can't go into a cave alone together, he's like, don't worry, I'm not going to come on to you, I'm in love with somebody else. And then Isabella and Matilda have a little spat over him, and then they kind of switch over into the, no, you should have him, no, you should have him, and they both become self-sacrificing caricatures of themselves. But
yeah, and what does it say that, you know, in more modern stories the pattern is that the direct damsel in distress, Isabella, would automatically get the guy who rescues her, but that's not the... Well, she does in the end, but just in natural in terms of emotion, it's actually the other way around, where Matilda, a woman, is given some power and frees Theodore, and their emotions, you know, and attraction are mutual, so...
It's a pretty non-traditional ending where, on the surface, it kind of looks like a happily ever after, but it's not. Theodore would have been happily ever after with Matilda, but she's dead, and he does kind of settle for Isabella. And, you know, they're both, the two of them have the best claims to the throne of Otranto, so by marrying each other, they've kind of settled. There's nobody else who's going to try to claim the throne. But it's not really a romantic happy ending, which I think in later Gothics you'll see there's more of a romance element.
Yeah, so what does that say about the fact that, you know, Manfred is portrayed as such a, you know, villainous character with his dynastic aspirations, but at the same time, basically the same thing happens, where a match was created to sort of squash any sort of, you know, rivalry?
Right, well, I think part of what happened is that there's this biblical notion of the sins of the father will be visited onto the third and fourth generation. And so Matilda and Conrad are the fourth generation after the original usurper, Ricardo. So even though Matilda is a good and virtuous person, she's suffering for the sins of her ancestor. And it kind of made narrative sense to kill her off, because you had to cut off Manfred's bloodline. That was his punishment for being a usurper. So she was kind of a tragic figure from the beginning, because there was no way that she could have had a happily ever after without that divine justice needed to come into fruition.
The sacrificial lamb.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I'm just listening to you guys. That's better. I did want to hit on something too. You mentioned the word romance, and kind of like the precursor of the edition that I read mentioned this as a romance over and over and over again, because of the tragic ending, which is the complete opposite of what the romance genre is now. You're kind of most of the time guaranteed a happy ending. I mean, that's my understanding of a lot of the genre. And then there's like a whole debate. If it isn't a happy ending, then is it a romance novel? So, I mean, those elements didn't really pop out to me when I read this, like the romantic element. So do you know why this was considered in that genre, or am I just...
So romance means two different things. At the time that this book was written, and the sense that we start calling these Gothic romances, romance referred to the genre of literature that was being written in the Middle Ages, and that's your knights in shining armor, you know, King Arthur, Knights of the Round Table kind of story. So a romance means a kind of fantasy story with knights, and maybe they have a woman who they're fighting for, but it wasn't quite the idea of a love story that we have today. Okay. And Walpole's idea in writing Otranto was that he wanted to bridge the romance and that kind of sense of fantasy and supernatural and knights and epic battles with the beginnings of the modern novel that seeks to present real people in realistic ways and not just flat characters. So that, in that sense, The Castle of Otranto was a modern romance.
And also, I think with, again, it tying Gothic literature in the whole Romanticism movement, because exactly. Romanticism wasn't just about, like, what we understand in modern times as love. It was also directly the screw the Enlightenment and, you know, screw classicism and, you know, focusing on other aspects of, you know, life and the human nature.
Right. Instead of just rationality, it wanted to focus on emotions. And Romanticism, more broadly, was all emotions, especially the sublime, but love, sadness, fear, everything. And the Gothic kind of zeroes in on fear, but a little bit of all the others as well.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
All righty, then. Were there any other points or interesting things you wanted to bring up?
Did we talk enough about gender in this? Did you guys have anything you wanted? I mean, we kind of talked about the damsel in distress, but what do you think about what the Castle of Otranto says about masculinity?
Oh, that's a good one. Ugh. Masculinity.
It's funny, Julia, because we, like, I think we ended Jane Eyre on this, like, a similar question about gender in the novel. I mean, it was kind of peppered in, but then we kind of talked about it more heavily at the end. I would like to hear y'all's thoughts before. I mean, we kind of talked about the female characters, but yeah, definitely the male characters and a little bit of self-sacrificing. That was Theodore, is that right? Or did I get his name wrong? Yeah, but.
Well, to me, Manfred, I think at the time it was his foibles and his flaws were supposed to be a reflection on the corruption on a political side rather than anything about gender. But in being a person in modern times, looking on it now, you could, you know, make the argument that Manfred encompasses all or a great deal of elements of what we would consider to be toxic masculinity.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would agree with that. His name is even Manfred.
Right.
Arrived at home. And I feel like early in the novel, Manfred sees himself as the epitome of masculinity. When he comes on to Isabella, he compares or contrasts himself with his son Conrad, who was a weak, sickly boy. And Conrad is kind of the, like, negative example of not being masculine enough. And Manfred says, well, why would you want a puny, sickly child when you can have me, a man in the prime of my life who would know what to do with a woman? And that's one view of masculinity that we're presented with. But then we have Theodore, who's kind of masculine, but in a virtuous and good way. And
the chivalrous way.
Right, the chivalrous way. he's very chivalrous, and he's also very, you mentioned self-sacrificing. He does seem to have a bit of this martyrdom, like, suicide mission kind of complex, where he's willing to rush in, and every time he meets a woman, he's like, I will die to protect you. and he's just so ready to die for any cause. But mostly that's because he has a good heart. And it's also interesting that Theodore, you know, he's been living his life as a peasant, and he gets handed a sword and is able to defeat a veteran soldier, Frederick, in battle and wound him. Frederick, who has just come back from the Crusades as a victorious soldier. I always find that aspect a little bit unrealistic, but it kind of just plays into the part that he's a magical, perfect hero who's able to do everything right.
Yeah, probably would get pretty ripped apart for that, if that was part of the story. I mean, it is part of the story then, but now, you know, I think people would toss it aside just due to that.
Alrighty then, shall we move to the Gothometer?
Yes.
Sure.
As I told you, our Gothometer is categorized into 5 parts, and it's called atmosphere/setting, the past, supernatural, heroes, heroines and villains, and then mysteries. And we rate each category from 1 to 10, and then by the end we compare, you know, our results for like how many points out of 50 points. So atmosphere and setting, Julia, how do you scale 1 to 10, how do you rank Castle of Otranto as in accordance with traditional Gothic atmosphere?
Yeah, I mean, we're in an ancient castle in a foreign land, but Otranto's kind of lacking, you know, there's not really a dark, stormy night or creaking noises or the kind of spookiness that we come to expect from the Gothic, so I'd put this at, like, a 5.
Mm.
Wow.
So Julia's at a 5. What are you, Jess?
Man, I was going to go with an 8 just because it's foundational. I think it's just, it seems, it's like the seed to me. And then everything kind of came from that, and everything kind of touches back into that. So I know, Julia, I know you were going to go first, and I knew my score was going to be totally, like, BS after this, but I guess I'll unconfidently stick with my 8.
Yeah, I was going to go with 9.
Yay! Because, okay.
Yeah, I'm going with 9 just because, again, I feel like there are multiple Gothic settings, one being, you know, the old country house or castle, and another being more urban. This definitely is the old country house, really old castle. Like some of the things Julia said, I felt maybe some of them fall within the supernatural category. So yeah, I'm gonna go with 9. Okay, so second category, the past. So in relation to how much the past has an impact on the current storyline, Julia, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm going to go with a 9 for that. We have, well, first of all, we have a prophecy that's kind of affecting everyone's actions. And we have the original usurpation that is having a consequence on everybody who's descended from the original usurper. And you have a literal ghost coming back to haunt things. So yeah, there's a lot to do with past generations and their crimes coming back to haunt the present.
Okay, Jess, what do you think?
I'm going with a 9, too. I know that's kind of a...
No, I'm a 9, too.
Okay,
so.
Well, we're
glad you're in agreement in this one.
Yes. Why not a 10, yeah, though? Look, why would we avoid a 10?
I don't know, because I know you have to be completely over the top.
That's...
You would have to be over top in a way that I feel like would be detrimental to the story rather than enhance it.
Okay. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, I was like, I feel like if I give it a 10, then I'm gonna regret that 10. So I feel good about my 9.
Okay, so again, the element of the supernatural, what do we think? There was the portrait, there's the helmet, there's, you know, all the mention the servants make of the supernatural. So what do we give it, Julia?
There's also one we haven't mentioned yet, which is the skeleton in the oratory, which is, I think, scariest part of this story. There's the old hermit that Frederick had seen in the Holy Land who had died and made him promise to come back and fix things over here. And when he's starting to think that he's going to give that all up to try to marry Matilda, the skeleton appears and reminds him of his promise. So I'm giving this a 10 on Supernatural because there's just so much and it's so over the top. We have skeletons falling from, or we have skeletons in the oratory, we have helmets falling from the sky, we have giant body parts that the servants are seeing all over the castle, and then at the end we see the entire giant of Alfonso, and he, like, destroys the castle as he, like, stands up and the walls crumble around him, and then he, like, flies up to heaven where we see a literal saint welcoming him into heaven. So that's so much supernatural. I'll give it a 10.
Okay, Jess. Okay, so Jess, what do you think?
It's hard not to give this a 10 for Supernatural. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, again, you know, kind of sets the stage for what's to come as far as the genre itself. And then that was why I liked it. You know, just when you thought was going to get less weird. I mean, it starts off with the giant helmet falling on somebody. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, all right, I'm ready. So I'll give it a 10.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a 10 as well, just because, like, in addition to all the things, you know, that Julia and you mentioned, it's also about the level of impact the supernatural has. It's not just like something like, oh, did that portrait really move? Did it not move? It's not just, you know, it's not just contributing to the psychological deterioration, like, of the person's, of the character, but it's like, again, Conrad dies, you know, right. all these really direct, important things happen, you know, as a result of all the supernatural elements. So for that, I give it a 10. Woo-hoo. All right. The notion of heroes, heroines, and villains. Julia?
Yeah, I'm a little torn on this one. It does establish all of your prototypical heroes and villains, but they're also pretty flat characters, and they're not super memorable. So I'm going to go with a 7 on this, because everybody's a little bit of a cookie-cutter hero and villain, but they do really serve as the foundation for later characters to build on.
Mm-hmm. Jess?
You know, when I think of this book, I don't think of characters, which is probably why I, you know, goofed up the names. No, nobody left like a serious impression like other works do. They were more just to, I don't know. I'm going to give it like a 6.
I think I'm going to give it an 8, because while I agree that the character archetypes are very flat and one-dimensional, to just have so many of them, the fact that there is a specific hero, there's a specific heroine, there's a specific villain, rather than to let one of them be abstract. Just the fact of the physicality of each archetype in so many characters, I think that's, I'm going to give it an 8.
Cool.
Okay, and then the level of mystery. Julia, what do you think?
I'm going to give this one a 7 as well, because there definitely is a mystery, and the mystery is, you know, what's causing this haunting, who is the true heir of Otranto, but we don't really see the characters actively trying to solve the mystery, and it's mm-hmm. not really contributing that much to the sense of suspense in the story, apart from, like, the ghost, but that kind of falls under the supernatural, so the mystery is there, but this, I wouldn't pick up this book and be like, it's a mystery.
Jess, what do you think?
I am going to agree with Julia, because, I mean, there is kind of, like, what happened, but it didn't really, the mystery was there, but it was light and not super engaging, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to be even meaner. I'm giving it a 5.
Good.
Just because I think it's from coming from Jane Eyre mm-hmm. last week, which was really, there is a very concrete, very modern mystery of who is the person making all the noises, who is this crazy ghost, or is it a ghost, you know, yada yada yada. So I think, you know, some of the mysterious elements I tend to put more in like the past category, like the notion of prophecy and like that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. I don't really consider some of those things in the mystery category. So for that, I'm giving it a 5. So let me tally up all of our scores here. So let's see. Forgive me. I know 5 languages, but I cannot do arithmetic to save my life.
That's fine. I should have. I was so caught up in my numbers that I didn't write mine down.
Okay. So Julia's score, she gave Castle of Otranto 38 out of 50.
All right.
Yeah.
And Jess, you gave it 40 points out of 50.
There we go.
And for me, I gave it 41, so I thought it was the most gothic out of all of us.
Well, we're all kind of like in the same range, you know? Nobody was like, we didn't give it like a 10 or something like that. So it's kind of like Jane Eyre. We kind of felt the same gothic level about it.
And I think that makes sense because, you know, as the original gothic text, of course it would be very gothic. But there were so many that came after that really piled on the Gothic once it had something to work with. So I think that's a respectable score for the Castle of Otranto.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and I like doing the Gothometer not because it's a fun exercise, but it also makes one think about, again, all these tenets that created and how those tenets like either combine with themselves or diverge to like kind of create the current, you know, mystery genres or the current paranormal subgenres that we have in modern literature. So yeah, the last exercise for the podcast is we do a special rereading where we pick one of us will pick a passage at random, maybe read a few paragraphs, and then we, you know, talk about what comes to mind. So do either of you have a copy of the book, you know, with you right now?
Yeah, I have my copy.
Julie, okay. I feel like since you're the guest, you should go.
Okay.
Okay, so yeah.
A random passage?
Yeah, just totally close your eyes, flip through the book, and just go somewhere.
Okay. How many sentences should I read?
Just like a few paragraphs, and then just stop whenever you feel like that's a good chunk to talk about.
I don't know how your copy is, but in my copy, it's like all one paragraph. But okay. Let me find the beginning of a scene here. "Give me thy beauteous hand in token that thou dost not deceive me," said Theodore, "and let me bathe it with the warm tears of gratitude." "Forbear," said the princess, "this must not be." "Alas," said Theodore, "I have never known but calamity until this hour. Perhaps shall never know other fortune again. Suffer the chaste raptures of holy gratitude. 'Tis my soul would print its effusions on thy hand." "Forbear and be gone," said Matilda. "How would Isabella approve of seeing thee at my feet?" "Who is Isabella?" said the young man with surprise. "Ah, me, I fear," said the princess, "I am serving a deceitful one. Hast thou forgot thy curiosity this morning? Thy looks, thy actions, all thy beauteous self seems an emanation of divinity," said Theodore. "But thy words are dark and mysterious. Speak, lady, speak to thy servant's comprehension." "Thou understandest but too well," said Matilda. "But once more I command thee to be gone. Thy blood, which I may preserve, will be on my head if I waste the time in vain discourse."
Okay. That's a really good one. That is, I assume, is when Matilda is freeing Theodore, which again is, in a way, its own inversion of damsel in distress, because now we have the woman in power freeing the hero, the young hero.
Yeah, that's a great point. He is the damsel in distress in this instance.
Mm-hmm. And I think it goes into kind of that general theme of, in a sad way, a lot of times the only way women could gain their own sort of agency or their own sort of power, it wasn't through being a wife. That was the worst way. The like two extreme ways were to either go into a convent and, you know, read the Bible and read other things, be educated, or be a prostitute.
Right. Yeah. That's pretty spot on.
This scene reminded me a bit of in Romeo and Juliet, the "Can our hands like pilgrims kiss" and all those lines. Theodore is using this religious imagery of like, oh, it's my holy tears that, suffer the chaste raptures of holy gratitude. That's why I want to kiss your hand. And he's kind of using this religious language to kind of cover his amorous intent.
Yeah. And what does that say? Like trying to sanitize an aspect of the human condition that society has, you know, pathologized and try to de-emphasize and diminish beyond recognition, like in terms of sexuality.
Yeah, and it's an interesting moment in his character, because for most of the time we see him being genuinely virtuous and displaying religious virtues. But in this instance, I think if he were to truly abide by his religion, he would not be trying to kiss the hand of a young maiden who's alone with him in a castle.
True.
So he's a little bit of a hypocrite here.
Yeah, is that I'm trying to think of the where in the Bible I'm Song of Songs, where that is. It's coming to me.
Probably anything about kissing is in Song of Songs.
Gazelle. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. I don't have a lot to say about that passage.
All right, then. Well, thank you so much for that special rereading, Julia.
You're welcome.
And this is the end of our podcast. Thank you so much for joining us, Julia. And next week, we will go into The Phantom of the Opera.
I have never seen The Phantom of the Opera. I take that back, a high school play. I have never read The Phantom of the Opera. I haven't seen the movie, so...
It will be interesting to see your first impressions of the novel, which I read it 2 years ago and I really, really liked it. And I'm like, screw the play. Why did they change everything?
I think that is how you'll feel about The Hunchback too. But Julia, any insights for us pre-reading or for Phantom?
I have not actually read Phantom, but I am a huge fan of the play. And I did talk about it a bit on my blog in my post on the naive trope of the naive young woman. And Phantom of the Opera does some very interesting things with Christine and the way that she relates to the villain of the story, the Phantom. So I'm interested to hear what you guys have to say about that once you read it.
Cool. Okay.
Alrighty then. See you guys later. And thank you so much for tuning in.
Thank you for having me. Bye.